Hey there, America. I'm Leslie Marshall. Good evening and welcome to the Hour 2 edition, Ivory Thursday, the Inside Scoop edition of the Leslie Marshall Show. My partner in crime and co-host is Mark Levine, and I hope you'll join us in this hour. Joining us in this hour, you can call us at 888-653-7543. Tweet us. Follow me on Twitter at Leslie Marshall. Follow Mark at Mark Levine Talk. In addition to that, like our fan page, facebook.com/TheLeslieMarshallShow, or send an email through the contact page of the website, LeslieMarshallShow.com. Mark, my co-host every hour to Thursday, is a former legislative counsel to Democratic Congressman Barney Frank and the House Judiciary, Homeland Security, and Financial Services Committee. He currently hosts the Washington-based radio television talk show The Inside Scoop and the Ruckus Caucus on Pacifica Radio, WPFW 89.3 FM. He also frequently appears on television, Fox, MSNBC, CNN, Fox Business, and CNBC. He's tangled with everyone from Bill O'Reilly on the right to his Pacifica co-host on the left, and he and I, like I say, like to tango hour two on Thursday. My co-host and partner in crime here, Mark Levine. Hey, buddy, how you doing? Good evening and welcome. Welcome back. Always good to co-host this hour with you.
Good evening. Always a pleasure to be here.
And always, I learn something every time you're on. I really do. And not sometimes from the political angle, always from a legal angle. And, you know, I love the law. Like I told you, I wanted to be a lawyer at one time, but just found that that wasn't for me. And you do politics, you do talk, you know, radio and TV, and you do the law. So you are a triple threat, as they say on Broadway, right?
I try to be. I certainly try to be.
Let's talk about, you know, the Republicans like to attack the Attorney General, and they've kind of died down on the Attorney General and the DOJ. But there is something I think a lot of people thought that would just go away, I think especially the African-American community. And there are many saying, nope, now it's not going to go away when you hear what the Attorney General wants to do. The Obama administration is moving, and some would say very aggressively, reasserting federal power and blocking state laws that allegedly violate the civil rights of minority voters. And basically, a lot of people feel, myself included, I'm sure you would agree, that minority voters' rights have been weakened by striking down a portion of the Voting Rights Act. Now, I'm sure most people listening know what happened with that, but let's just do a quick recap, if you could, Mark, of what happened with the Voting Rights Act, why it came up to the Supreme Court, and why what portion of it was struck down and what that means.
Sure. Well, the Voting Rights Act, of course, is part of the two twin pillars of civil rights, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Civil Rights Act of 1964 is what ended segregation in America. It's what allows African Americans to go to movie halls and restaurants and theaters, because, of course, in the South, they used to be segregated or prevented from doing that. The Voting Rights Act is probably equally important because it was the act that finally allowed blacks to vote in the South. For more than 100 years after the end of the Civil War, the blacks had the technical right to vote, but Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, practically all the southern states would not let them vote. And they would not let them vote sometimes just through rank intimidation, but otherwise through all kinds of schemes and tests, literacy tests and poll taxes and demanding to know how many jelly beans are in a jar and demanding that uneducated people read the Constitution and explain every word of it, and all kinds of things and tests they didn't impose on white people. So you had something like less than 5% of blacks voting, and of course, in those states, that meant Republican control. Well, now Texas is, so the United States Supreme Court recently, just about a month ago, I guess, struck down one part of the Voting Rights Act. What the Voting Rights Act did is it subjected these states that had a long history of racial discrimination and said that before you change your voting laws, before you put back in literacy tests or poll taxes or redistrict your lines in a way that prevent blacks from having any meaningful electoral say, you have to go through a preclearance process either by the Justice Department or the U.S. courts. And what the Supreme Court struck down was naming specific states. Basically, what the Supreme Court said is Alabama's no more racist than Rhode Island, and Texas is no more racist than Massachusetts. And you know, even though Congress found that to be true, it was true 50 years ago. You haven't updated your formula. So they threw out this preclearance process, at least before Texas or other states have new laws that oppress minorities. But it left in place other sections of the Voting Rights Act, sections 1, 2, and 3. Specifically, section 3 does allow the Attorney General, in an appropriate case, to come back in and say, hey, Texas, you're doing it yet again. This isn't a test from 1965. You're doing it in 2013. You're discriminating. And so, because you have shown that you always discriminate against minorities, we're going to make sure that you get preclearance all over again. And that's exactly what Attorney General Holder is doing.
So basically, this is an Attorney General, talking, like you said, on a federal level and, you know, sticking his middle finger up at the Supreme Court. He's basically looking at the facts of the state of Texas that have a history of discrimination. And some, you know, I've lived in Texas. I lived in Houston in 1992, and it definitely was a heck of a lot more racist than, I must say, most places I've lived. And this is no offense to Houston. This is a reality where it was very odd to have, when you go into a restaurant, blacks sat with blacks and Hispanics with Hispanics and white with whites. And maybe there'd be some overlap, more white and Hispanic overlap. But I had a multicultural table, us being in the industry, you know, broadcasters. And that was always odd. I went to a black church with one of my black friends and was warmly welcomed. When she came with me into a white church, that was not the same. In reverse, unfortunately and sadly. When we look at what the Attorney General is doing, there are those also obviously critics of the Attorney General, critics of this administration, not just Democrats, who perceive this as being personal because obviously Attorney General Eric Holder is an African-American, as is the president, or at least the president's half African-American. Do you think that a white Attorney General would be making the same, would actually ask Texas to submit all the proposed changes for approval, reasserting such authority as Attorney General Eric Holder is, especially if it was a Attorney General within a Democratic administration?
I certainly think so. I cannot see Bill Clinton's Attorney General or Jimmy Carter's Attorney General or most specifically Lyndon Johnson's Attorney General doing anything but that. The heart of this case, I wouldn't say Holder's quite sticking his finger at the Supreme Court because the Supreme Court only struck down part of the Voting Rights Act. They only struck down the part that dated from 1965 where they named the states that were racist in 1965. The Supreme Court didn't happen to care that there was a provision already that if you weren't racist for 10 years, you got removed from the list. They didn't care. They said it was an old list. So what Attorney General Holder has the right to do, or any Attorney General of the United States, is to make a new list. And that's not Section 4 and 5 that were struck down, but Section 3. And it requires an active Attorney General. You're right about that. I mean, I don't think George Bush's Attorney General would be going up against Texas. But the heart of how you know that Eric Holder isn't doing anything extraordinary or untoward is that he is acting on the basis of two federal court decisions. So Texas already submitted its redistricting plan and its voting ID plans to the courts. And the reason they went to the courts is because Texas says, well, we can't trust Eric Holder, to be fair. We're going to go before federal courts. So they had two separate panels of three judges. And in one of the panels, two of the judges were appointed by George W. Bush, former governor of Texas. And in the other panel, one of the judges was appointed by George W. Bush. But all six judges, whether appointed by Bush or appointed by Democrats, all six judges unanimously found that not only were Texas laws racist, they were intentionally racist. It's hard to do that. It's hard to prove that people are intentionally bigoted. But all six judges, again, including judges appointed by George W. Bush, three of the six, found that Texas intentionally used race in drawing its district lines and intentionally was trying to keep blacks and Latinos from voting and from having any real political power. So the evidence was so overwhelming that they wrote in a footnote, they said that we don't have to give all the evidence that shows this Texas is racist because there's so much there, we'll just give you enough to prove it and we don't have to look at all the other evidence because it's overwhelming. When you have that strong a statement by federal judges, including Republican, conservative Republican judges appointed by Bush, all of them agree Texas is racist, I would think even a Republican Attorney General would have to abide by the courts and say, well, we got to look into this.
When we look at what legal scholars are saying about this, and I mean, you know, I consider you as an attorney, and not just an attorney, but with your background. I don't know if you want to use the word scholar, if you like that. But
just call me a constitutional lawyer.
I think an expert on constitutional law. This is a battle, and they say that this battle comes with big stakes. Explain what the stakes are and why this is such a big battle, other than the fact Texas has such a Republican government within that state and that it's such a large state and such a red state.
Well, here's why it's a big battle. So Texas, in the 2000 census, was a 52% white state. Since that time, they've had a lot of growth, and 90% of the growth has been from non-whites, from mostly Latinos, also African-Americans, some Asian-Americans. So that means that today, Texas is a majority non-white state. It's only 45% white. But when it was majority white, they elected people who are redrawing district lines so they stay in power even though they're a minority. It's actually very similar to what they did in South Africa. I've been willing to call it apartheid. Because what they do is they draw the lines so that all the Latinos and blacks are resegregated into Bantustans, you might call it, where they put in 100% or 95% blacks. And at the end of the day, 70% of districts in Texas are majority white. Now remember, the majority of the state is not white. Only 45% is white, but 70% of their districts are white. And they even went so far as to do things like remove the economic engines of districts, to go into the head of the Congressional Black Caucus and remove just her home from her own district, and things that were so clearly not coincidence, like I said, that even conservative Bush-appointed judges said this is nonsense. You're intentionally using race to discriminate. And Texas is basically thumbing its nose at the United States government and saying, look, we have a right to do Jim Crow. The Supreme Court said we have a right to be racist. Texas has a long, proud history of racism, and we can do racism better than anyone. When a state does that, to me, that's like waving a red flag in front of a bull. It's like South Carolina saying they want to secede. Texas wants to refight the Civil War, and any federal government that didn't go after Texas, I think, would not be true to, frankly, all the Union soldiers that died in the Civil War.
Really, when you look at this, there can only be one motivating factor why a state like Texas, or any state, especially when one is in the South, and how do you, after our history and continuing history, how do you defend such stringent voter ID laws? The motivation for this must be, we have a black man as president. Democrats have just, you know, they're gaining seats in the House. They have a majority in the Senate. We're scared they're going to get into the White House in the next election or so. Hispanics are increasing. This is not just about blacks, but I think, you know, people of any color, and blacks as well, because blacks are growing in population as voters and growing in population, period, and faster than whites. Doesn't this come down to not just discrimination, but this comes down to fear, and this comes down to trying to, like they did with redistricting, hello Tom DeLay, hello from Texas, gerrymandering, the district so that it would be in their favor politically when it comes to, you know, how many people can get to where and can't get to where. This puts just one more obstacle in many lower income communities' way.
I think it comes down to power. I think the Texas Republicans that control the state know that they are a minority, know if they let everyone vote with fair elections, they'll be kicked out. And so they're doing exactly what the whites in South Africa did. They say, we're in charge now. We want to stay in charge. We don't care that we're not the minority. We're going to manipulate the voting system to stay in charge. And in Texas, it's mostly anti-Latino. It's anti-black, too. But the issue in Texas is mostly preventing the new Latino population from having any real political power. There was enough population to gain 4 new seats in Texas. Most of them would go to Latinos. Instead, Texas took one seat away from the Latinos and added 5 new all-white seats. And that's another reason why the federal court found that Texas was intentionally being discriminating on the basis of race.
We're going to take a break, and we'll be back with my buddy and partner in crime, co-host in this and every second hour on the Thursday edition of the Inside Scoop of the Leslie Marshall Show, Mark Levine. Follow Mark on Twitter, @MarkLevineTalk, and tweet him. We'll incorporate your tweets during the show. You can go to the website and send an email to Mark. MarkLevineTalk.com is his website. We'll be back with you. And we're back. I'm Leslie Marshall. My co-host is Mark Levine. Check out his website, MarkLevineTalk.com. Email him there. And on Twitter, @MarkLevineTalk. Tweet me, @LeslieMarshall. And send an email through the website, LeslieMarshallShow.com. Also, call us, 888-653-7543. Mark is my co-host, and we are talking about so many issues tonight. Let's move on to another one, because, you know, we have so much to talk about, Mark, and only 1 hour to do it. Let's talk about John Kerry. I mean, John Kerry's gone to this is a big deal. I mean, you know, could there be peace in the Middle East after 9 months? Most people, not just pessimists like myself, are skeptical that it could be, although I do want a rah-rah for John Kerry. Some people, you know, say that, hey, Hillary laid the groundwork for this and Kerry's getting all the credit. But, you know, John Kerry, first of all, has been to the Middle East 6 times in the 6 months he has been, approximately just more than 6 months now, Secretary of State. Can he succeed in this mission when he faces the same issues that have derailed so many previous peacemaking efforts? And peacemaking, you know, I mean, the closest we ever came to peace was before Yitzhak Rabin was assassinated, and that was Bill Clinton. Obviously, Democrats seem to do better to broker these deals, but I'm being partisan, of course. Shame on me, right? But let's talk about this. Can John Kerry succeed where everyone else has failed when he has the same obstacles?
I was going to say we probably came closest to Camp David just at the end of Bill Clinton's term. Look, if I were a betting man, I would certainly bet against John Kerry. That's no insult to John Kerry. It's very easy to bet against a Middle East peace agreement. If you'd taken that bet, you would have won from 60 years. But I can't say I have no hope, which that in and of itself is rare, because usually I have no hope when it comes to Middle East peace. I think Kerry is doing as good a job as anyone could do. He has worked very hard to get the Arab states involved. That's very important for Israel, because they want that legitimacy, so that it won't be a peace just between the Arabs of the West Bank and Gaza, but between virtually all Arab nations and Israel. He's worked very hard. He pushed Israel to release about 100 terrorists, I mean, people who had murdered people, bombed children, and so forth, to show their good faith, trying to negotiate with the Palestinians. I got to tell you, Kerry has moved a lot further than I would say anyone since Bill Clinton in 2001, and though I'd still bet against him, the fact that he has a chance to succeed, that in and of itself is rare and a wonderful thing, and I wish him luck.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back. I want to ask one or two more questions on that, and then we're going to move on to something else regarding the NSA. Back with my co-host, Mark Levine. Hope you'll join us at 888-653-7543. Follow me on Twitter at Leslie Marshall. Follow Mark at Mark Levine Talk. Back to you right after this, folks. And we're back. Hey there, my co-host and partner in crime, Mark Levine. I'm Leslie Marshall. Mark, welcome, folks. Welcome or welcome back. Mark, I wanted to know, do you want to talk more about Kerry or do you want to move on to NSA?
Your choice, Leslie. Wherever
no,
you
really.
Want to go,
what do you feel? I can go either way.
I didn't know if you had one more question on the Middle East.
I want to know what is the big appeal with Kerry, because Hillary's pretty much loved in the Middle East, and she did spend a lot of time going back and forth as well. So why do you think he got them to the table? And quite frankly, does gender have anything to do with it? Because you know that's whispered behind closed doors sometimes.
I don't think it's gender. I think that Kerry is conducting a lot of this very secretly, very, very quietly. Hillary Clinton, I think, focused on a wide variety of things as Secretary of State, which ordinarily I think is the right thing to do. I certainly think there are many, many issues of concern other than what's going on in Israel, particularly even in the Middle East. I mean, there's what's Iran and Libya, of course, Clinton was involved in that, and what's going on in Syria, I've talked about a lot as a horrific thing. In fact, Kerry's been criticized, I think, for focusing almost exclusively on the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. And I actually have some sympathy with that criticism. But I just think it's a matter of focus. I think Hillary Clinton was more widely focused and Kerry more narrowly focused. And if he succeeds, he'll be a hero. If he fails, then people will say, well, why weren't you more broadly focused?
Yeah, you can't win. And one more thing, and then we're going to take some calls, tweets, and stuff like that before we go into the NSA chat. I don't think, I lived in Israel for 3 months in 96, and I know it was a long time ago, and a lot of it's changed. As a matter of fact, it was more peaceful than it is now, but I don't think they want me peace in the Middle East. That was my experience in 96. I do think that there is a segment of the population, but when you have not just politicians, but people building and moving into settlements, they don't seem to want peace. They say, you know, it's like many Jews, Israeli want Israel for themselves. Many Palestinians are like, you know, screw it. We don't want to recognize you and want the whole thing. And, you know, I think they're just saying nice and playing nice to pretend to want peace, to shake hands, to have a photo op. But at the end of the day, I don't believe this will happen either, because I honestly don't. And it's terrible. I don't think it'll happen in our lifetime. And I honestly think it's because both sides want what they want. And in a negotiation, the only way you can win is if both sides lose something. You can't have everything you want on both sides.
I don't know if this is true of the Palestinian Arab population, but having spent some time in Israel myself, I can safely say that a third of Israelis would do almost anything to get some peace settlement, including giving up half of Jerusalem, anything.
That's a minority.
Well, that's true. One-third of Israelis absolutely do not want a settlement and believe that they can just be there forever. And the middle third of Israelis, the people who decide the elections, believe there should be a peace agreement if they can have security, if they know it's safe, if they know they won't be doing what they did in Gaza, where they gave up land and it became a terrorist state. So I think there's, like I said, a third who will never compromise, a third who will always compromise, and the middle third is saying, show me, let's be convinced. I think on the Arab side, I don't know that it's a third, but I definitely know that there are people in all three camps as well, people who definitely don't want any kind of compromise, people who would do almost anything for peace, and another middle group that wants to see what's available. So my hope is that we can appeal to those two middles, but maybe I'm an incorrigible optimist. Like I said, I still bet against it, but I always want to believe it's possible, and my optimism may be clouding my judgment here.
Let me ask you something, Mark, on that. One more question, actually, just came to me. I'm half Jewish, as you know, and the wrong half, my daddy, you know, not necessarily by people like you, you know, who are more open-minded thinking. But I'm wondering, you are a full Jewish man.
And you're married to a Muslim man, so you've seen both sides.
Well, he doesn't practice, I don't practice.
Well,
I don't practice.
Secular.
We believe in God, you know, so we don't get into the religion thing. But I wanted to know, because I, being half Jewish, half of my family's Jewish, and I have Jews that are very pro-Israel, and then I have Jews in my family like my cousin Tracy, who before I knew you were gay years back, I was going to fix you up with, and she's very, very liberal, and she's pro peace, although she's probably even more pro Palestinian. And we have these huge fights sometimes, like around Thanksgiving or, you know, Passover, whatever. And I was just wondering where you stand. And I say that because it would seem that the younger Jews of America are becoming more pro peace and even more understanding or open minded toward the Palestinian plight, whereas their parents or grandparents, absolutely not. Like when I was a kid, even though I'm not that old, but when I was a kid, until 1996, honestly, I was pro-Israel because I kind of was brainwashed and conditioned that I had to be with the family I grew up in. Even though my dad was Jewish, we lived and grew up with his family in the Boston area. So I grew up culturally Jewish. My mother's family was in New York, the Italian and Irish Catholics, who I really didn't see much at all, and they died when I was young. So I grew up with an entirely Jewish family and a non-Jewish mother, pretty much, you know. So I always say, you know, culturally, I was brought up Jewish. So, and half religious, depending which grandparents had me which weekend, you know. So, you know, I'm just wondering where you stand from a personal perspective, if you don't mind sharing that.
No, not at all. Look, I think that there is a very strong tie of Jews toward Israel, and I'm certainly feel very strongly Jewish and in that sense strongly pro-Israel. I'm not Orthodox. I don't keep kosher. I'm not that traditional, but you know, I fast on Yom Kippur. I keep Passover. I'm probably average for an American Jew in terms of religiosity. I don't think a lot of people, non-Jews, recognize the history. I mean, Christianity, of course, comes from a religion. The very name, Christ, which means Lord, comes from Jesus. Judaism is interesting because Judaism is a newer word than Judea. Judea is the land of Israel. It's the land from which Jews come. It's the land from which Jews are named. Just like Arabs are named for Arabia, Jews are named for Judea. So the religion came later than the land. And in the same sense, it's true for, you know, Greeks or French or Romans or England, English, whatever, people who are named for their land. And I think a lot of people, because, you know, Jews haven't had sovereignty in Israel from, you know, 70 AD till 1948, people think of Judaism as a religion alone, but there's definitely a strong national element and identity to the land. So I think most Jews do feel that strength. Now, the question for Israelis and for Jews is not, do they have a strong affinity for Israel, but can they share the land without risking losing everything? And I think that up till 2000, the vast majority of Jews and Israelis said, sure, we need to give up land in order to have peace. And then they gave up Gaza, and Gaza became a Hamas terrorist state. And so now they're saying, we were just fools. We gave up this land to get peace, and we got, you know, people, you know, throwing rockets into our cities. And so I think Israel today is much more skeptical, saying, well, we're not going to be that stupid. We're not going to again give up land where people can shoot rockets into us. If you could persuade them that the Palestinian Arabs were not going to shoot rockets at them the way they did in Gaza, I think you would get a peace deal in Israel.
Okay, and then one last thing also I do want to mention, and I know this without going into great detail, but trust me, Judaism, one thing Hitler was right about, don't flip that I'm saying this, but Judaism is actually a race. It is a race. And actually,
I would say it's a people. Or
No. I have scientific evidence in my own blood that it is a race.
I don't think it's a race anymore.
No. It is a race. Can I tell you? You want me to tell you how?
Okay.
In 2004, I was pregnant with a child that had Canavans, which is like Tay-Sachs, my son who passed away.
Right.
And when they did testing, they said, although you're only half Jewish, you have 100% Ashkenazi. In other words, I have my father's genes were much more dominant than my mother's, and I am according scientifically, my race is Ashkenazi Jew. In other words, I don't show any Mediterranean or Irish enough to be considered, believe it or not, Mediterranean, Italian, Caucasian, whatever. I am Ashkenazi, and I said to the geneticist, and I said, this is a geneticist with, you know, degrees from MIT, who I'm not going to argue.
Right.
I said, wait a minute. I said, you know, so I said, Jews are a race? And she said, oh, yes. And she goes, there's Ashkenazi, there's Sephardic. She goes, there's you know, 3 to 7, depending how much you break it down. And I said, then Hitler was right. And she goes, in that area, yes.
Here's how I'd put it. Look, you're right that there are certain genetic diseases that go.
No, not just genetic diseases. I am Ashkenazi, so that is a race.
So am I. But to give you an example, you've met me. I'm relatively dark skinned, right. And so we can't prove it because
you can prove it. Go to a geneticist, and they will tell you what your race is.
My mother believes, because we're all a little dark on her side, that we were Sephardi Jews, and when they kicked us out of Spain, we found, you know, refuge in Poland and Russia. So, you know, the point is that Jews as a people are larger than just Ashkenazi. Ashkenazi means German, by the way. It's Hebrew for Germany, and the Ashkenazi Jews were originally from Germany. The Sephardi Jews were from Sepharad, which means Spain.
Right.
And basically, the Sephardi Jews lived under Muslims, and the Ashkenazi Jews lived under Christians, but there's also Yemeni Jews, and Indian Jews,
right,
and even
right.
Chinese Jews. So Judaism is larger than the group of Ashkenazi people that are part of it. So I still reject it because there are people of all races. There are black Jews, there are Asian Jews. You can convert to Judaism, you can leave Judaism, and you can't really convert to a race or leave a race. That's why I prefer to call it a people or an ethnicity, even though...
That's exactly my point. See, this is my point. I want to get to Charlie in Los Angeles because he's never called us before. He's calling on something totally different, and we got to get to break. So, Mark, let's take Charlie, and then we'll take a break and then revisit that. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, sounds good. Let's go to Charlie in L.A., where I am in Los Angeles. Hey, Charlie, good evening. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Leslie, how you doing? Thanks
good.
For having me on.
Thanks for joining us. What did you want to say?
So I was discussing, I follow you on Twitter, and you had talked about the Riley Cooper incident.
Yes, yes.
Reason for why we need the Voting Rights Act.
Yeah.
And I was calling on behalf because I look at it actually from the exact opposite reason, which is it's the reason why we don't need a Voting Rights Act, because if you look at the reaction to it, it was an immediate firestorm, and he has been banished off to the side, which proves that the majority, vast majority, believe what he did was absolutely wrong. Now, had it been the reverse reaction, had people stood up for him and cheered for him and said that was a good thing on a whole, then I would say you absolutely need the Voting Rights Act. But because the reaction was so aggressive against it, it actually proves the opposite of your point.
Okay. Can I respond?
What would you say, Mark? Because one of the things I would say is I'm not a huge sports fan. I wouldn't necessarily have known about this, honestly, except for my great producers, and my producers also happen to be sports fans themselves. But when I wouldn't have even known who it was, guys, okay? But Charlie, do you really feel that those who know Riley Cooper, you know like who Mitch McConnell is? And I say that because don't you think they're two different circles? Mark, would you weigh in?
Well, I would just say there's a huge difference between some guy, some sports star, or some whomever, using a racial slur, and Texas removing 2 million people from the voting rolls. I mean, this is not Texas saying, we don't like them N-word. If they said that, I'd have less of a problem with it. Instead, Texas is actually taking away their right to vote, saying to an 80-year-old black woman, you voted for 50 years, but we're not going to let you vote anymore. To me, that's real and much more severe than anything Riley Cooper had to say.
All right. Anything else, Charlie?
No, that was it.
All right. Thank you, buddy. Appreciate you following us on Twitter. Hope you'll
thank
keep
you so
listening to the show and calling as well. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, we'll be back with my partner in crime, my co-host. And we're going to debate and tangle a little on the Ashkenazi Jewish race situation. But we're also going to come on and talk to some other topics, NSA being one of them. Don't go away. Mark Levine is my co-host. I'm Leslie Marshall. You can join us at 888-653-7543. But let me share some tweets before we do that. Kathleen Wells says Ashkenazi Jews have no right to Israel. They are from the Khazar area, and Ethiopian Jews are treated like trash in Israel. Well, in 96 they weren't. They were more than welcomed when I was there. And we will come back to you right after this. We're back. I'm Leslie Marshall. My co-host is Mark Levine. And before we get to NSA, love your response on that tweet from that woman who says that Ashkenazi Jews aren't entitled to Israel. My attitude is on Israel that anybody who's Jewish as a Jewish state is entitled to Israel. Although I do have to say, Mark, with relatives that have died in the Holocaust, as I'm sure you have too, and people that know what it's like to be oppressed based on their religion. And although a third of Palestinians are Christian, two-thirds are Muslim, I just don't understand anybody in Israel saying to anybody, that to me, Israel, there should not be after living in a place that wanted to get rid of you because of your religion, you shouldn't say, well, this is a Jewish state, although you can come in, but we hate those of you over there and you're associated with a very, very small minority of people who are bad within that population. That bothers me. I mean, I even know other Jews who would say, when some people say, well, the Palestinians aren't oppressed, it's like they haven't been to Israel. They're clearly oppressed. And that's what bothers me. For people that came to Israel and created and fought for and developed Israel, the state of Israel, because and out of this, quite frankly, very similar oppression, not exactly, not genocide, but similar oppression based on religion, and differences of life and lifestyle, that bothers me, the hypocrisy of that.
Well, look, the Arabs who live in Israel and have Israeli citizenship have full and equal rights under the law. The only thing they don't have to do is they don't have to join the military. Though, interestingly, there are Arab Israelis that do join the military. Namely, the Druze population has asked to be drafted just like the Jews. And there are Druze serving who are Druze religion is kind of an offshoot of Islam, and those Arabs do serve. So the real problem has to do with the Arabs living in the West Bank and Gaza. That's the real problem. And the issue with them, of course, is that they... I believe every people should have a state. The question is just where do we draw the lines? And as far as I'm concerned, the West Bank, the 10% or so that's Jewish should go to the Jews. The 50% or so that's Arab should go to the Arabs. The remaining 40% should be divided between them, but probably given mostly to the Arabs. But I don't think the issue is so much persecution as where to draw the lines.
All right, let's talk NSA. And before we do, let's talk about what Putin has done. Putin said, look, you're not going to get asylum to Snowden if you release more documents. More documents were released. Of course, some people say The Guardian had those documents all along. And now the president says, not sure I'm going to have this summit. Can favoring Snowden actually hurt Putin? Because doesn't the United States offer him more than Edward Snowden?
You know, I don't think we should make such a big deal over Snowden. I've felt all along that what Snowden was exposing were things that I already knew when I worked in Congress. And frankly, that Ron Wyden, Senator Wyden of Oregon, has been trying to tell us for years now. I mean, it's right there in the Patriot Act. It's right there in the reauthorization. It was frankly in New York Times articles in 03 and 04 that they were gathering up all this phone data from all of us. And I guess some people thought, well, Obama won't continue what Bush did, but he did. So I don't find it that much of a surprise. I actually think Snowden did us a service by having us talk about it. And obviously, most people weren't focused on it until then. And the best way to know that is the incredible bipartisan vote between Congressman Amash and Congressman Conyers, you know, far right and far left, coming together. And they got within 8 votes of getting rid of this spying on American citizens. I mean, I'm a strict constitutionalist. I think that if you've got a Fourth Amendment warrant, that the probable cause to believe that someone's committed a crime or a terrorist or a foreign agent, then spy all you want. But if you don't have a warrant, you don't have probable cause, and these are American citizens, you shouldn't be spying on us. And so, you know, I'm not going to defend what Snowden did. He gave away secrets that I'm sure he shouldn't have given away. But I don't think he's all traitor either. I'm glad we're having this discussion, and I don't think the government, either Bush or Obama, were forthcoming about these things before Snowden.
Let's talk about the NSA. See, it's weird. Even though I'm a liberal and I want people to have rights and I want to have people to have privacy and I went ballistic over the Patriot Act, I've got to say, Putin, I think, is a huge hypocrite. I mean, this is a guy that worked for the KGB. This is a guy that was a spy. We have Russian spies here. Why aren't we allowed to have spies there and everywhere else in the world? I mean, seriously, we have seen from nothing else. We have seen from Timothy McVeigh. We have seen from the Tsarnaev brothers. We have seen that we have enemies living among us. Why wouldn't enemies be living among our allies?
Yeah, please don't get me wrong. I'm certainly not defending Vladimir Putin for anything, nor would I ever. But I just think that if we have a tip that someone is a terrorist, if we have reason to believe someone's committed a crime, go to a court, get a warrant, and spy on them all they want. I'm fine with spying on the Tsarnaev brothers. There was information there that we had that had given us a tip to spy on them. What I'm not fine with is lumping you and me, Leslie, and all our listeners and hundreds of millions of Americans and gathering up all our phone data in case they need it someday.
Yeah, but isn't there a difference between gathering the data and being able to read the data? My understanding is they don't have the capability to actually read the data without going through all those channels, which take time.
Well, that's what they say, but I just
Can I ask you something? Can you at least agree with me on this and admit this? If not another 9/11 or worse, God forbid, happened tomorrow, how many people would say that the president and NSA weren't doing enough?
I understand, but I think that
it's easy for us when we're not kissing our asses goodbye to be worried. But the day after 9/11, which Chris Christie referred to, and it scares me when I agree with that man, but the day after 9/11, which Chris Christie refers to, he's got a very good point. On that day, we didn't care. Right? We didn't care about that. Mark, this hour always goes by so fast. I love being with you. Every second hour, every Thursday, the Inside Scoop edition of the Leslie Marshall Show with my co-host Mark Levine and I, Leslie Marshall.